Hello and welcome to the Choking on Truth podcast, where our aim is to cut through the superficial and get to the heart of the matter. We talk about various topics including grinding for success, jiu-jitsu, mental health, community, and social issues. Sometimes the truth is a hard pill to swallow, so our aim is to shed light on the importance of choking on the truth. Episode 1. Today's guest is no stranger to the world of violence and self-defense. He worked as an undercover officer and SWAT team member in the Chicago area. He is a black belt in jiu-jitsu, a master instructor in self-defense, firearms shooting training, and hand-to-hand combat. Those who know him love him. He is a sweetheart and a certified badass. I'm your host, Steve Winjet, and he is Mr. Paul Sharp. You want an honest man, but you don't understand. I won't be here when you wake up again. You want an honest man, but you don't understand. I won't be here when you wake up again. Got so much I need to cover. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, man.
Welcome, Katie.
Hi.
She's our fact check.
She's our Jamie.
She's going to check that. Is that true?
I'm going to make sure it's real. His real name.
Image searching Jamie. Me right now. Is that really Paul Sharp?
Yeah. Is it really him?
Legit.
Sometimes.
All right, cool. So it's cool to have you here, Paul. Definitely honored that we're kicking off this maiden voyage of this podcast with you. I had the pleasure of the past couple of days to spend some time with you. You just delivered some rocking material at Straight Blast Gym Edmonton. How's your trip been so far?
It's been awesome. I love it here.
Cool.
Yeah, you guys are awesome. Love the vibe of the gym. It's like walking into home, you know, so that's really cool. And you're one of my favorite people, so that helps too. I mean, Katie's cool, but you know, but
okay. She's a little high maintenance.
Yeah, yeah. She's fact checking everything I say. She's like, does he in fact like Straight Blast Gym Edmonton? Is this a fact?
No. Nope.
But no, man, it's been a great trip. And the weather's been nice this time. So that's been awesome as well. Last time I was here was a polar vortex. So.
Yeah, it was cold.
Yeah.
It was cold.
Just a wee bit. It was actually 40 below and it's been 40 above this time. So in Fahrenheit.
I don't know.
I don't know what. The temperature isn't Canadian, but in Fahrenheit, it's...
I don't know what the temperature is in Canadian either. I don't have room for that kind of stuff in my brain. I'm just dip my toes outside. Yeah, it's cold.
It's cold.
Yeah.
It's good. Put something on, more than a hoodie on, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? You rocked it this weekend. You rock it every time, so every chance I get, you know, I like to be in your seminars. I echo that. You're definitely one of my favorite people, one of my favorite instructors, and you keep it real and down to earth, and I love that.
Yeah, thank you.
Right?
Thank you.
So, I guess kind of jumping into it, I got some questions for you, mostly just really share who you are with the world, or at least whoever listens to this podcast. Hi, Mom. Yeah, I guess we'll get into it. So can you talk a little bit about how you got started in martial arts?
I always tell people I started martial arts when I was 7 or 8 years old when I first started wrestling, because I consider wrestling to be a martial art. I trained in that pretty much from that point until now. I still wrestle as much as possible, as much as my body will let me. And then boxing shortly after that. And I kind of took a circular journey to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. John Cavanaugh one time said to me, why did you ever stop wrestling and boxing? You know, because we were talking about our journey, you know, and how I ended up going through all these other paths. And then I ended up back in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, not back, but I ended up back in grappling. And Cavanaugh was like, why would you ever stop? You know, and to somebody like him, who's really smart, you know, it just seems like an obvious thing. Like, why would you quit? Somebody like me, who's not so smart, you know, I always thought, well, maybe there's something I'm missing, you know, and sometimes you know, it's just curiosity. You know, I'm just naturally curious. And so I took Ishinru, I took Weishiru, karates, I did judo when I was a little kid, Goju-ryu, and then American Kenpo, Chinese Kenpo, you know, K-E-M-P-O. And,
yeah.
And I did the American Kenpo with the N, you know. So I did that, and I did pretty well in that stuff. I liked it, you know. Got some mid-grade belts in those arts, and I did Wing Chun, Kung Fu, and that kind of led me into eventually, well, two things happened. One is I was too old to wrestle, so you can't really be a 26-year-old guy showing up at some kid's wrestling practice, you know, it's kind of weird, mm-hmm. unless you're a coach. So I didn't really have an outlet for that, and that's really what I loved the most, was just wrestling was my first love. And so... and I didn't have the academics to go to college, do a college scholarship or anything like that for wrestling. Like, it wasn't going to happen. So at a certain point, I had to kind of face reality and say, you know, what am I going to do now? You know, so as far as martial arts go. So I got into all the other more traditional martial arts, and the Japanese and Okinawan and Chinese martial arts. And then... I was living in Florida, South Florida, and a friend said, if you're going to do martial arts, I would do the one that Bruce Lee does, you know, and be completely transparent, I've never watched a Bruce Lee movie from start to finish. I have much respect for, why are you looking at me that way? Kate's going to fact check that, I'm going to fact check that completely. I've never watched a Bruce Lee movie start to finish, although I have a lot of respect for him, you know, and for the things he wrote about martial arts and about training and philosophy, you know, but movies just didn't appeal to me, you know? So I had no idea that he had come up with a martial art or developed this thing. And so I checked it out. I found a place near me. It was run by Dwight Woods, which Matt just did a podcast with Dwight.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's kind of a weird, right? Like, my world's coming back together. And Dwight was probably one of the, just a sweetheart of a guy, you know, just the nicest guy I'd ever met in that world, in the martial arts world. Because I was used to these guys who were kind of like, bow to your sensei. And, you know, you must address me without making eye contact and that kind of stuff that's kind of sometimes happens in the traditional martial arts. And so I met him. He's very welcoming. So I started training with him, but then Hurricane Andrew happened and literally blew everything away. You know, there was no place to train for some time. And then one of his instructors opened a satellite school at a Sun Gym, I believe, a little closer to my house up by Pembroke Pines. And so I continued my JKD training after that. And about that time, Paul Vunak came through. And he did a seminar, and instantly I connected, because he really focused on efficiency, what is necessary for the fight, and just personality wise, you know, he's a very charismatic guy, and connected with him. And I asked him if he had any instructors there. And he also showed what he called Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. And he showed a escape from mount. So basically trap, bridge, and roll. He showed a guard, basically how to play guard, and he showed how to pass the guard. And so he showed three or four things, and I think he showed an Americana, and instantly I felt like I was home again. And so I said, hey, how do I find more of this stuff, you know? And he introduced me to a guy there named Carlos Hernandez, who was a police officer in Hialeah, and he's now mayor of Hialeah. And so Carlos was running a progressive fighting systems training group, and I started training with those guys while still training with Rick Perdomo, Dwight Wood's instructor, one of Dwight Wood's instructors. And so I was kind of mixing a bunch of things together and training. And somewhere in there, one of the guys in the group with Rick Perdomo, one of the guys in there said, hey, there's a seminar coming up with this Gracie Jiu-Jitsu stuff that we learned when Vunak was here, you want to go? And I said, sure. And having no idea what I was going to see. And it was Hickson, but I didn't know how to even say his name properly.
And it was Rickson.
Rickson. Yeah. I just did not, you know, I was like, it's an R, you know?
Yeah.
And so we went to this seminar, and he tapped everybody out, of course. You know, it's the 90s. Nobody had a clue. And he tapped me out with a triangle in like seconds. And instantly I was just, that was it. Plus, Hickson looked and moved and acted like all the wrestlers I had grown up around. You know, he just kind of had that vibe, that energy, you know. And so that I connected with that again, you know, kind of felt like home. And so I started looking for a Brazilian jiu-jitsu place. There was a guy there who trained with Marcus Savey, Conan Savey. And so I started training with those guys and with Carlos at the same time. So I kind of dropped off from the JKD side of the house as far as the kind of the approach that Dan and Asanto and those guys, the Jeet Kune Do concepts, I guess, side of the house. And it really wasn't, at that point in time, it really wasn't a, I think that's not as good as this, or I think this is better than that. It was more of a financial thing. You know, I just couldn't afford to keep paying for gym dues at three different places, you know? So, yeah. Okay. You know, and that was basically it, you know? And so I had to make a decision, like, where am I going to train? And Carlos and those guys, Luis Gutierrez was one of the guys there, and we really hit it off. You know, we were pretty good friends, and Carlos and I hit it off pretty well as also. So it more came down to just the social aspect than anything. And Carlos and those guys trained at a place called Lord's Gym, which is a really hardcore boxing gym. And so that also kind of appealed to me at that time, especially at that point in my life. There weren't a lot of family type people there. It was fighters, guys that wanted to fight, guys that had fought maybe in the past, but didn't want to let it go, you know? So we're still there trying to get after it a little bit.
So basically like a gladiator pit.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. And so there was a guy there, Tony Hernandez. He was a former Cuban Olympic boxing coach. Roberto Duran would come through there. Razor Ruddock. There was a bunch of guys that would come through there. And, you know, just impressive people. Mm-hmm. And so, and then there was a bunch, there's a huge Cuban judo community in that area, guys that are high level judo players and older guys, you know, back from like when, not quite pre-boat lift days. So there's the boat lift from Cuba to the United States. And then there's the days before that where guys just, you know, they saw Castro coming and they bailed and got out of there. So there's a lot of those guys in that area. So a lot of those guys trained at that gym. There was a matted area, and I'd see these older guys in there just throwing people effortlessly. It was beautiful, you know? And so I thought, well, I only have so much money. I have, you know, a small kid, my son, you know, was just a little dude, and I have another one on the way. So got to make a financial decision. So I chose to stay with Carlos and keep training there in Lord's Gym, and also training as often as possible with Conan and those guys doing straight Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And that kind of set me on the path towards Thornton, towards Matt and SBG. I read an article in Inside Kung Fu, I think, written by Burton Richardson. And he wrote an article about the Straight Blast Gym and about Matt Thornton and these guys who were doing this form of JKD that was what maybe JKD should look like. You know, it was more fighting oriented and more direct and efficient. And that really got my interest going. And at almost the same time, Lewis says, hey, man, I've got this guy coming here. I've been talking to this guy through email from Portland who's really cool. He thinks like we do. Sounds like he trains like we do, you know, because we were already just like getting after it. We would just put motorcycle helmets on, big sticks, and just swing at each other and try to knock each other's head off. And just all the stuff that you see in like the original SBG videos, you know, yeah. that kind of stuff, just beating the crap out of each other. And we were entering kickboxing competitions. We were in boxing competitions. We would enter judo and it was called shudo at the time. There were some guys in South Florida that were trying to organize shudo America type thing. And we were just competing as often as possible. If we could fight, we would be there. You know, if it meant they're going to put somebody in front of us and we could fight them, we wanted to do it, you know, just to see what works and what doesn't. And so Lewis is like, hey, man, you know, this guy, Matt, he's on the same page as us, except maybe he's a chapter ahead. Because, you know, Matt, and you know, Matt, you know, I mean, the guy is a brilliant thinker. Absolutely. When it comes to this stuff, you know, and I would put him on like PhD level. As far as like, I've been around PhD guys, right? They're a small percentage of the population has achieved a PhD. It's a respectable thing. Yeah. And I would say Matt's at that level as a thinker, you know,
for sure.
And so he was already at that point in time, even though he was still as Neanderthal as us, you know, as far as like getting after it and just beating the crap out of each other. He still, though, was very much a thinker. And so he had already codified a lot of this stuff. Like, back then, you know, the aliveness triangle, he had already put that together. He had already put together adaptability as one of the traits of that we want to strive for. And as far as the straight blast gym, or as far as the training curriculum goes, you know, the adaptability being the ability to fight in stand up, clinch your ground, you know, he had already put together, he later called it SMACK, which was the stick program, basically hit the lead leg, hit the weapon bearing arm and hit him in the head, you know, like that's your targeting areas. Everything else focuses around that. So he had really done a lot of this stuff from the mental side. I mean, physically he'd done it, but mentally he had put it all together. Whereas we were kind of still like, we were like scrapbookers, you know, trying to put stuff together. And he's already over here, like creating walls of art, you know?
Yeah.
So, he went to Lewis's gym in Florida and I was supposed to go. Sorry, I was supposed to go at that time to the very first seminar with Lewis in Miami, and I couldn't make it because of work stuff. But I just started at the police department shortly before that. I couldn't get the time off from work. I'm a new guy, right? So no time. And so I couldn't get the time off. I was disappointed, but Adam and Rory Singer went, and I kind of knew those guys peripherally through Progressive Fighting Systems. I'd heard their names and, you know, always heard good things.
Yeah.
And so they went. And so during that trip, Lewis became an instructor with Matt either the second time Matt went down there or the first time. And then the next time, I think it was the next time, Adam and Rory became instructors. And then, so then it just wasn't working out. So I had Matt come out to me. You know, I said, hey, man, you want to come out here and do a seminar? And so he came out and he did a seminar at that time I was teaching in someone else's gym. I was running their MMA program. I really didn't have my own place or anything. And I was partnered up with another guy. We were teaching I was running his MMA and competition team stuff because that's all I was interested in.
Yeah.
And Matt came out and we trained, we talked and spent a lot of time together. And then when it came on Sunday, he said, hey, man, I think I've heard good things about you from the other guys. And I think you'd be a good fit for our organization. So I'd like you to be one of our instructors and represent the gym. And I was like, yeah, man, I mean, I don't really know what that means, but I'm in, you know? And so that's when I became one of the instructors. So I think technically I'm the third guy outside of Portland to become an SBG instructor because Adam and Rory are one, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
for sure.
They're actually number two. So Lewis was one and Adam and Rory were two and then I'm three. So if Adam and Rory want to divide it up so that they're two and three, then I'm four, but whatever, you know.
They can be, I don't know, like two.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're like Bradgelina or whatever it was, you know, where they just combined their name into one person. But yeah, so that was the beginning of, that was my journey, kind of brought me to where I'm at and what I do now. And I focus primarily now on jiu-jitsu, grappling stuff. I don't do a whole lot of striking anymore, just due to some brain injury, that kind of thing. Yeah,
I'm hoping to touch on that in a bit here.
Yeah, man, for sure.
I want to jump in the Wayback Machine a little bit and ask you, you had mentioned law enforcement, and I was wondering if you'd be willing to touch a little bit on what your role was in law enforcement. And
So I started in 98, so I got hired back way back then, and I started out as a patrolman, patrol officer. Working basically in a squad car and responding to calls and handling calls for service. And I eventually became a what they call a resident officer. And that's where they pick a at-risk neighborhood and they place a house in that at-risk neighborhood. And you, your job is to bring the services of the city, kind of act as a liaison and bring as much services that the city can offer to that neighborhood to help kind of turn it around, get it back on track. And that was a very enlightening period for me because I think one of the things that happens in law enforcement is a lot of the guys that are in law enforcement have never lived in those neighborhoods or lived that life, you know, and that's good and bad. Like, I get it. You know, I understand why they don't want a guy who's got a criminal background or something like that to, you know, be in that position. At the same time, though, I think if a guy screwed up at some point in his life, but he's got his act together and he's never done it again, then that it shouldn't preclude him from the selection process because real life experience is important. You know, you got these, you got a 21-year-old kid, 23-year-old kid, you know, standing in some guy's house and the guy's like in his 40s or 50s. He's not going to be too inclined to be lectured by this kid, you know. But if you got a guy who's got some life experience and can relate to this guy, it might calm things down a little bit, you know, rather than escalate. And so as a resident officer, I worked with code enforcement. I worked with all kinds of things. Public works is what it's called in the States, but basically like the guys that do like the snow plowing and the garbage removal and tree trimming and all that stuff. I worked with those guys, to clean up the neighborhood, you know. I understand there's some controversy. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the broken glass theory or broken window theory, but
no.
Rudy Giuliani, I think it was Rudy Giuliani, is one of the guys who really grabbed onto that theory and used it in New York to kind of clean up the city. And it got some controversy because people were like, it's overreaching, it's all these other things. But essentially the theory is, if you park a car on the street and you leave it untouched, nothing will happen. All right, leave it there for a couple of weeks. If you break a window in that car and leave it, within a week, the whole car will be trashed because something about that barrier being removed. And so they kind of took that theory and would apply it to neighborhoods. So if you have a house that's run down and trashed, it causes people to then allow their home to become run down or their... And there's a lot of back and forth about that. But at that time, I really looked at it and I bought into that. And I thought, okay, well, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to make people proud of their neighborhood, you know, make people proud of the street they live on, you know. So I'm going to, so I would go and I would, they call it tag a car, but I would mark cars as abandoned, you know. And we send letters to the registered owner of the car, say, hey, your car's here. It's been sitting here for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, you know, flat tires, everything else. Either come get your car or we're going to tow it. And if they didn't, we'd tow it, you know, and impound it. And we did a lot of that stuff and just started cleaning up street by street. I just did it section by section and just we would get rid of the cars. And then we would try to get the sidewalks repaired. If I couldn't get the sidewalks repaired, I'd get a like a power washer or Public Works. They were Public Works guys are really cool. Like they would help me. Like they knew what we were trying to do, you know. I never got any resistance from those guys. They were like, yeah, you want that sidewalk power washed? All right. You know, which is kind of, you know, which, and by all rights, they could have been like, no, that's not my job description, you know.
Yeah.
But they were down, man. So they would come out and they would power wash the sidewalk, which sounds silly, right? But you have a dingy looking sidewalk because whatever. And then they come out and they power wash this thing. And now it's like clean and shiny. And then you see people, I would see people now come out and sweep this, their stoop.
Yeah. Right. So you literally cleaned up the street.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So then that's what we started doing. And then building trust in the neighborhood with the people that live there. You know, they have to know that, that you're not a fly by night. They got to know that you're going to be here. So consistency, right? Just being there every day. Just doing your what you can to make the neighborhood better, which sometimes might mean arresting one of their family members. And then so you run the risk of them being mad at you, you know, because, yeah, you cleaned up my street, made my neighborhood look better, but you just arrested my kid, you know. So it's like, you know, it was a delicate line to walk, you know, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, I'm cleaning up the street, but your kid's standing out here slinging drugs on the street corner. And whatever our thoughts might be on that, whether that there should be prohibition or not, here's the thing. For now, it's against the law, which means black market forces being what they are. If you're selling drugs on this corner and I don't have any drugs to sell in this corner, the way I get drugs to sell in this corner is I shoot you and take your stuff, you know, and then take over your spot, you know, or I fight you or something like that. So, with that being the issue, I would go out there and stand next to those guys so they couldn't sell drugs. So I would just go stand next to them, you know, yeah. Like, hey, what's going on, fellas? What are we doing tonight? You know, and they're all like, come on. You know, they'd walk across the street. I'd write them a ticket for jaywalking.
Nice.
You know? Like, you just walked across the street without using a crosswalk. I'd be like, are you going to be petty like that? And I was like, yes, because you're selling drugs in front of an apartment building. And if somebody does a drive-by on you, the rounds that come out of those guns are going to hit that apartment building and there's kids in there. So, yeah, I'm going to be that petty. If that's what it takes to make you go either go elsewhere or find something else to do. You know, and so that's the kind of stuff we would do. So that was a good experience for me. And from there, I went back to patrol for a little while. I did 4.5 years in that division. And I went back to patrol, and then I worked undercover for several years. And then I also worked in a project called the Neighborhood Police Project. So it's kind of like the resident officer program, except you don't have to live there. So I did that for a few years. And then finished up my career working in patrol, you know, kind of back where I started, which was good. I like patrol because you're out in the car, you know, you're driving around the neighborhoods, you can get out and walk, you know, talk to people, talk to business owners. And just, I find people interesting, you know, so you get to talk to people, you get to know people and, you know, so I like it, get to know your neighborhood. Plus I live in the town I work in,
yeah,
you know, so I always thought that was important too, to kind of be out and about.
Have your finger on the pulse sort
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah, and I understand the argument from guys that say, I don't want to live in the town I work in because I don't want to be in a grocery store and have somebody I just arrested walk up on me while I'm standing there with my kids.
Yeah,
I did have that happen a couple of times, you know, and it's a little, you know, a little unsettling
yeah.
to say the least. But at the same time, I also felt like I'm working in the town that I live in. It gives me a little more of a stake in the game, you know, like I've. This is important to me too. Like I want my neighborhood safe too.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm working for my neighborhood. It's not just someplace I come to and work and then go home, you know? So I don't know if that makes sense or not.
But makes perfect
yeah,
sense.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then the whole time I was doing that stuff, I also was doing SWAT, you know, I was working in with the SWAT team and I worked as a firearms instructor and defensive tactics instructor. I taught empty hands or hand to hand, whatever you want to call it. Knife defense, pepper spray, a little bit of everything. The only thing I didn't ever teach was taser. I got tased, but I didn't teach it. The taser taught me, you know. Yeah.
I saw the video. It looked pretty electrifying.
Yeah, it was awesome. So that was probably one of the more painful things I've done. Yeah.
Yeah, it made me sad when I watched it. I was just like, oh, Paul, why are you letting them do that? Yeah,
quivering around and stuff, crying.
So for the undercover, like, I'm sure that would interest a lot of people. Like, what what sort of things came up when you're working undercover?
So a lot of times, again, man, just because I find people interesting, you know, and I'm just this, I'm curious by nature. So I ask questions and talk to people and kind of interview everybody, you know, in a weird way. At least that's how one of my friends said it. One of my friends is like, you're always interviewing people, you know. But it's not that. It's just that I just find them interesting, you know, and want to know more. So I would talk to these guys a lot of times when I was working undercover and kind of get a little insight into what makes these guys tick. Like, how did they end up on this side of the fence? You know, because I kind of looked at it like, you know, the difference between myself and a lot of these guys was just simply one decision. Yeah. Like, one point in time, they made a decision that put them on this path, kind of that trajectory thing, right? Like, at some point in time, they encountered something that altered their trajectory, and they were never able to dig themselves out of it. And I'm a firm believer that you could dig yourself out of anything. Like, you know, like we were talking earlier, like, you can have issues, all kinds of issues. You could have burnt every single bridge in your life. That doesn't mean it's over.
Yeah.
That just means you can't go back to those places, but you can move forward, you know. And it might not be the life you wanted, but it still can be a good life. And so I would talk to a lot of these guys, and I was just continually interested in the role that abuse, or whether it's substance or physical, whatever it might be, the role that played and how they ended up where we are right now, you know?
I'm kind of smiling at the irony of it being that you're sitting in the, you know, studio with somebody that you're talking about right now.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It's
one of those guys.
Right, yeah. It's like, how did they end up in this spot? And a lot of times it was like, hey, man, like, abuse played a role. You know, and not really. And that's the thing. Like, we say, you know, it's a choice. And it is, right? It is a choice. But you have to understand that if your filter is altered, what looks like just a idiotic choice to me or to you or just someone else might look like a perfectly sane, rational decision to a guy who just doesn't know any better, you know, and his life has been altered in such a way. So that was one of the big things that really I came to with all of that stuff, was just that, you know, working undercover, you know, I think people think that I would talk about like some hairy, like crazy, you know, life or death fight or something like that. But, you know, that kind of stuff happened, you know, but what I really think about most of the time is just people, you know, conversations I had with dudes where I just, you know, like, oh, okay, that's why or how this happens. This is how we ended up here, you know.
That doesn't surprise me. I mean, having watched you teach, like, that's why I feel like you're able to really connect with a lot of people, is because you're interested.
Yeah.
You know, you're interested in, and you're engaged in their process.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, just stuck on you and what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really interesting, you know, when you talk to these guys and gals, to find that a lot of times they had struggled with, you know, like different forms of substance abuse or whatever it might be. And, you know, there's all kinds of addictions, right? It's just how we play it out, you know? And, you know, whether it's the guy who's spending 30 grand that he doesn't have on some shopping, buying stuff that he doesn't need, but he can't stop himself, or it's the, you know, a gal who's spending that much on Adderall, you know, it's like, what are you feeding, man?
Yeah.
You know, what are you trying to cover up? You know, what are you trying to deal with? What are you suffering? You know, what's going on in there? And so that's what I started noticing with these guys, is like, man, you know, the difference between me and those guys, even though in some ways our background was really similar, you know, with the things that happened at home and stuff like that. But it just was, at a certain point in time, they encountered somebody or something that took them down that path, whereas I encountered somebody or something that took me in an opposite direction.
Yeah.
You know, And rather than getting in, you know, like I've never done drugs in my life, you know, rather than going that direction, I went the other direction. I went into sports and I went into all kinds of other stuff, playing music. And I had, even in playing music, you know, I had a person who said to me one time, you know, I'm a kid, you know, I'm backstage and I'd never seen anybody do heroin or anything before. And this guy doing heroin. And I remember like watching him, you know, the whole process. I was like, what is going on here? You know, like taking the cigarette filter out and putting it in a spoon and the whole thing. And I'm like, what is going on right now? You know, I was so confused. I had never seen this, you know, and I see the whole thing go down. I remember he looks at me after he, you know, he like had a like a bandana and he like pushes it back and then he like injects and then he pushed the bandana back up over it. He looks at me and goes, don't ever do this. Don't ever do any drugs. Don't smoke weed. Don't do anything. And he kind of like, you know, the drugs hit him, you know, and he went out. And that was such a powerful moment, you know, completely altered my trajectory.
Yeah.
You know, like I never touched anything again. I just was like, I don't know what just happened. I really don't understand what at all what just occurred, but I do know this. That was powerful. You know, like it just like punched me right in the face.
Do you think it was the sincerity?
Yeah, he was completely,
you know.
Yeah, he was completely authentic. Like he was not, it was almost like a desperation. Like, yeah. I can't stop myself, but you can. You know, like I can't help what I'm about to do, but you can. Like, don't ever start. And I remember thinking, okay.
I think sincerity is it's a powerful catalyst.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like,
if it's not sincere, people don't pay attention, but I think we crave sincerity.
Yeah.
Especially nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's so hard to find it. You know, there's so little real life connection with other people.
Yeah.
You know, we live in a world, it's funny, we live in this world where you watch social interactions happen, you know, through media or whatever it is, you know, it's like dating happens through an app,
yeah.
You know, like social interactions happen through an app or through a, you know, some sort of media. And then you get the same people in a room and they don't talk.
Yeah.
Because they're all looking at their phones and nobody's engaged with each other. Nobody's asking each other questions like, hey, you know, what kind of job did you have in high school?
Yeah.
You know, I always think that's an interesting question, you know, because you'd be surprised what people say, you know, and it's like, you shined shoes? You know, like, seriously, man, you shined shoes in high school, you know, and, or different things like that. You know, I have a friend that, you know, he worked in a French fry place, you know, because I grew up on the East Coast, you know, near the ocean. And he worked at a Boardwalk Fries place in Ocean City, nice. You know? And he's like, you know what I discovered is that peanut oil, that's the secret to making good fries and a good tan. And I was like, seriously, man? You know? But that's the cool stuff that you find out by just talking to people.
Yeah.
Having like real, genuine conversations. Like, I want to know what you did during the summers in high school. Or did you work during school, you know what I mean, like that kind of stuff. Like, how did you do whatever it is you do? Like, how did you get here? What brought you here? You know, that's always like a really cool conversation to have with people.
Yeah, for sure. Know?
So, yeah, I don't know how we got there.
Yeah,
but that's cool.
But we got there.
Yeah, that's cool.
I agree. I mean, I've recently just learned to start. You know, I'm learning how to ask questions because I always was of the impression that people don't want me to pry.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I know most of the best conversations I've ever had were when I just allowed myself, one, to be vulnerable, and two, to be curious.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, sure. I think they're definite ingredients for connection.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's just that desire to like learn about something. You know, and I think so many people live in a world now where nobody's interested in them.
Yeah.
And hopefully I'm wrong. I could be completely wrong about that.
Well, they're interested in them through like a, you know, like 2.5 by 4 foot screen.
Yeah. Can I scroll through, like flip through their Instagram and look at pictures and stuff like that? And then I'm as guilty of that as anybody, you know? I mean, you really can't do business in this time without social media, without a presence, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and the, there's the other side of social media too that I like, man, which is, you know, I can see like your kids, you know, like your kids program. I can see Travis and Kiza or Leah or one of those guys running the kids class in Kalispell, or Cody, you know, running his program. And he's also one of my favorite people, you know, just a good guy, you know? Yeah. And, it's like I can, so social media has this more positive to me, more positives than negatives.
Yeah.
Part of that is I manipulate my algorithms, you know, so I like stuff that I want to see, and I just click the, I don't want to see this button, you know, on stuff I don't want to see. And that's nothing against anybody, but I just, I don't want to see political posts. I don't want to see divisive posts. I don't want to see that kind of stuff, man. And I want to see good stuff, you know? And I think I feel like I spent 20 years of my life seeing bad stuff, you know, and fighting a constant battle in my head to remind myself that in law enforcement, you deal with about 15% of the population, you know, you deal with, and you deal with the same people all the time.
Yeah.
You know, you deal with regulars, you know, and fighting to remind myself for years, and kind of like we talked about before, the importance of a mentor. You know, I had a mentor that told me, his name's Padilowitz, Bob Padilowitz. He's a Vietnam vet, and he was a training officer when I got hired. He's the guy that hired me, and just a good dude. And he would tell me all the time, you got to remember that the majority of the people are good people. You're just never going to see them.
Yeah.
Because when was the last time they needed 911?
Yeah.
You know, they don't, you're just never going to see them, you know? And so I had to, so after years of having to have that internal dialogue of, okay, I'm leaving work now. I'm going to the regular world. I'm going to go have a coffee at a bagel shop, and I'm going to look at regular people.
Yeah.
And to remind myself that this is the majority of the world, not the show, you know, the circus I just saw for 8 hours or 9 hours. So that was the thing. So now when I get on social media, I consciously choose to not see garbage.
Yeah.
Like I don't want to see, I don't want to see animals being hurt. I don't want to see stories about kids being abused. I don't want to see politics, divisive, people angry at each other. So the positives of social media for me outweigh the negatives, but I do understand that the other side of that is it's allowed us to disconnect.
Yeah.
So you'll have people sitting in a room with each other, liking each other's posts, but not talking to each other.
Yeah.
You know, and I've been guilty of that, and I've had to force myself to, I remember thinking like, this is ridiculous. You know, they're sitting across the table from me.
Yeah.
Why aren't I just having a conversation with them?
Yeah, for sure. You know? That's one of the things, like when I go to a camp or attend a tattoo convention, I always try to make like a status update that says, hey, this is where I'm at. If you're there too, and we only know each other on social media, come and meet me.
Yeah.
Come and talk to me.
Yeah, yeah, let's talk.
Right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's the biggest reason I'm on social media. I get to, you know, see what's going on with yourself and, you know, what's going on with Matt, and see what's my mom up to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Exactly. And, shit, my mom got hacked again because I'm getting, I'm getting inbox messages from people I know I'm already friends with, you know?
Of course.
But yeah, I mean, I guess in a lot of ways, it's like a firearm, you know, like either you're doing good with it or you're doing bad with it.
Yeah, it's just a tool. So how are we going to use it?
Exactly.
You know, and that's the thing. So I've finally figured out that you can mess with those algorithms a little bit by liking certain things and doing searches for certain things. Like if you search for certain things through the search bar in Instagram or Facebook, it'll actually set you up to see that stuff.
Oh, they're listening. When we were at dinner yesterday, remember I brought up the D&D, or we were talking about D&D, Ninja Turtles D&D books?
Yeah.
Well, when I went on my phone this morning, sure enough, there's an ad for Ninja Turtles action figures.
Like, yeah, right?
Really, dude?
Exactly.
You know?
I blame Thornton.
Yeah, it's Matt's fault.
I sent him a text, and I said, hey, man, like, I understand now. You're not on a mission to create jujitsu scientists or martial arts scientists. You're on a mission to create like some sort of Dungeons and Dragons nerd army. You know, that's what you're really doing.
Well, it's working.
It is, man. It's a fun game.
It is.
Yeah. I was like, I had no knowledge of that game. I knew nothing about it. I really didn't. You know, I didn't even know that I knew anybody that played it until one time I said something to Matt a long time, like years and years ago. I said something to Matt about Dungeons and Dragons or something like that. And he's like, I played Dungeons and Dragons. And nice. I was like, okay, well, you probably should never say that out loud again. You know, like never admit to that again, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we laughed or whatever. And then, but I never played it. And then at Matt's house, it was Salome, Diggins, Pete, Goshen, and myself and Matt. Matt was the dungeon master, of course. He's got to be in charge because, yeah, you know, it's Matt. But he set up a game, and man, we played. It was fun. You know, he like helped me create a character.
What was your character?
Oh, man, I don't remember. I don't think it was a paladin. I was like a combo. I was like a hybrid type thing.
We'll have to look into that. I'll have to look it up. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to look it up. I still have everything. You know, I still got all the stuff, so I have to look it up. But it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing that was going against me was I was there to teach, and for me, teaching seminars and stuff can be kind of exhausting.
Yeah.
And because you're talking and moving and, you know, trying to like make sure everybody. I want to make sure when I teach a class, I want to make sure I get what Travis calls one touch on everybody. So either eye contact, physical contact, or you say their name, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's really important because, again, right, so much of us go through every single day of our life with little to no contact,
yeah,
with another human being that actually cares and wants to connect, you know? So I try to do that, you know, after hearing Travis talk about the importance of that, I'm like, yeah, that's true, man. Like when I teach, people need to know I'm interested in them. I'm not just there going by rote, you know. It's like, yeah, I care about this material. I care about you. I want you to get it, you know. So when I teach, I'm usually wiped out by the second day.
Yeah, and it comes across. So, you know, like consistently comes across that you're there to give of yourself and make everyone better.
Yeah, cool.
You know.
Yeah, so. Thank you. I try, you know. But we were playing Dungeons and Dragons, man, and that was the second night, you know, and I was wiped out. So they probably took advantage of me. They probably were cheating, you know, and I just didn't know enough about the game to know that they're beating me up and cheating. But I was so tired, man. We played, and I just, at some point in time, I just said, Matt, man, I'm fading.
Yeah.
You know, I gotta go lay down. And so I went, excuse myself, and I went and laid down. I don't know what time those guys finished playing. They were still playing, like, when I was dozing off, they were still going after it. So but yeah, I think, you know, the thing is, here's the cool thing about that game is it forces engagement.
Yeah.
Like it forces you to engage with others, like to work together, to talk, to, like, you can't just be like video games. And again, I'm not a gamer. I don't know anything about video games, but I do know I've seen people play video games, and it's like everybody's in their own little world.
Yeah.
You have four or five guys sitting in a room playing a game, and nobody's talking to each other. They're all kind of spaced, you know, they're in their own space. I get it, you know, the headphones and all that stuff, and got the controller. So their world is right here.
Yeah.
You know, but with that kind of game, or like the traditional board games and stuff like that, I think I see value in it that I didn't see before.
You know? Yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, man.
I DM for the kids.
Yeah.
And I'm just getting into it. Matt actually got me into it.
Yeah.
Bought a starter kit and,
nice,
you know, got us all excited about it. And the thing I like about it is that, like, when you're DMing or when I'm DMing, watching the kids problem solve and learn how to communicate with each other.
Yeah.
Is like,
yeah, right.
It's amazing. And you can almost reinforce it when they start arguing. It's like,
yeah,
you know, the troll hears the ruckus in the other room because you guys can't make a decision, and works his way into the hall. And you know what I mean? It kind of teaches them causality without it being you know, something that ruins their life.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Teaches them how to communicate without like an iron fist
right.
behind it. Right.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Kind of like the old days, you know,
yeah.
where, you know, a parent or a teacher would tell you, you know, so I want you to sit there and talk for 5 minutes. So yeah. If you're going to fight, I want you to talk. You know, like, that's only going to make us want to fight more.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. But this is, you know, so it's really cool, man. I like it. So.
For sure.
Yeah. Freaking Matt, man.
He's
on a mission.
Next time you play, he'll probably be like, because you went to bed. Now you have demonic syphilis. Your character is like, yeah. I don't know.
I think they were being nice to me. And freaking Diggins, man, that dude's a savage.
Yeah.
He went and competed that day. Unbeknownst to, like, I think it was because he didn't come to the seminar. And so he said, hey, you know, I couldn't make it to your seminar because I decided to compete on Tuesday. So on Tuesday, he decides to compete on Saturday.
Yeah.
So like 3 days out, 4 days out, he's, hey, I'm going to go do this competition. And of course, he wins 5 matches, you know.
He's a beast.
Yeah. And he goes up against this guy. I'm watching the video and the guy made Diggins look like a little kid, you know, and Diggins is a big guy, yeah. you know, and he makes Diggins look like an adolescent. The guy's like 280 pounds, brown belt, you know, some sort of NCAA wrestler guy, just a beast. And Diggins just spider monkeys this guy, gets on his back, does that Kimura he does where he climbs over your back.
Yeah.
And yeah, just phenomenal. Just fantastic, you know.
Oh, for sure. So I just want to touch too on you had mentioned the like brain injury or aneurysm.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
It was a brain hemorrhage with intracranial pressure.
Okay.
So basically a brain bleed and then my brain was swollen.
What year did that happen, Paul?
2014. November 9th, 2014. So a couple of days before my birthday, my brain decided to ruin my birthday party. You know, had my birthday party in critical care. So good times. They wouldn't even let me have cake.
Mm.
You know, just evil.
So was it a sudden thing? What was the buildup like?
Yeah, so it took a couple weeks. It took a couple weeks of just sharp headaches, sudden headaches. And I learned later they're called thunderclap headaches, where it feels like somebody slaps your head really hard, like both sides of my head. It would feel like somebody just took their hands, just boxed my ears, you know, kind of like that, you know, like Captain Kirk would do when he'd fight aliens and stuff, you know, you like judo chop.
I have no idea. I'm a Star Wars fan.
That's your second goodness. Star Trek reference this weekend.
I like Star Trek. I never got into Star Wars too much until later in life. You know, I was always a Star Trek guy. So I had a thunderclap headache and I had a couple of those here and there, not too bad, but I'd never really been a headache person. You know, I would have bouts here and there. I had a migraine and cluster headache when I lived in Florida. That was a result of a reaction to an antibiotic I had taken while I was down there. And it caused me to have just a massive migraine, cluster headache. And I didn't really know what it was. I just knew I had a headache. And I never felt pain like that before. I never really had headaches before. And so that was really my only reference point prior to having an aneurysm for something that was a bad headache. And so all I thought was, I have some sort of migraine, I've got some sort of stress headache or something, I just need to drink some more water, I'm dehydrated. Because when I had the headache in Florida, the reaction to the medication, they told me, listen, you're dehydrated. You know, you're living in South Florida, it's 95 degrees at 5 in the morning, 100% humidity, probably should drink some water. You know, more than what you're drinking. And so that was my reference point. So when this started to happen, I just kept trying to drink more water. Kept thinking, I'm just dehydrated. I'm training a lot. I was rolling a lot at that point. I've always had this 6x6 philosophy, which is six hours a day, 6 days a week. And so I want to train 2 hours of skill 2 hours of strength and conditioning and then 2 hours of rolling or something, you know. And I've always kind of had that approach to my training for pretty much as long as I can remember. And so I thought maybe it's finally catching up to me. You know, I'm in my 40s. Maybe I can't train this way any longer. I'm dehydrated. And so I'm just downing water and I'm taking salt. I'm salting everything. I'm even salting my coffee. Not even joking. You know, I'm putting salt in the grounds to try to help myself stay hydrated, to try to retain fluids, and nothing's working. And I'm smelling stuff like burning, the whole thing, all these warning signs. And then I'm having vision issues with my left eye. My left eye is basically weeping all the time. So I'm just, water's just running down my, to the point my eyelids irritated. Like in one of the pictures that my daughter took of me when I was in the hospital, my left eye is just bright red and irritated because I was constantly wiping it. You know, of course everybody's messing around with me. Like, you know, I know you I tapped you out, but you don't have to cry about it. You know, yeah. And I'm like, whatever, dude, you know? Mm-hmm. So, eventually it got to a point to where I couldn't, the pressure was so bad in my head and it was just on my left side, like a line going straight from my eye back to the base of my skull, just right over the top of my head. It got to the point to where I could not function. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't, you know, I was in incredible pain. So we had a seminar with Carlson Gracie, black belt at our gym. This guy named Ben Salas, a really cool dude, came in, did an awesome seminar. We close up the gym. I come back the next morning. I close up the gym. I go home, but I can't sleep. And I have to work that night. So I work the midnight shift. So I'm working 10 at night to 6:30 in the morning. So I work overnight. Still haven't slept. This is about the third day I haven't slept. And we have wrestling practice that morning. It's a Sunday. So I go to wrestling practice and I can't wrestle. Like standing up was just causing excruciating pain. Anything but laying flat was causing me pain. And that was basically because my blood pressure would raise when I stand. And that was causing the pressure in my head to become just excruciating. But I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know what was going on. All I knew was every time I stand up, the headache gets worse, you know? And so we get done with practice and I really didn't roll at all. I didn't do any wrestling. And guys are leaving, they're closing up. One of my guys says to me, "Hey man, you look like you're dying. Are you okay?" You know, like, you know, like, "No, I'm fine, man. I'm just going to close up. I'm going to go home and take a nap. And then I'll go to work," because I had to work again that night. And so at this point, my thoughts were the headaches, everything else is like this self-feeding loop, you know, because I can't sleep, which because I have a headache, which causes me to have a headache because I can't sleep, you know. And so I end up taking a spill. I'm trying to lock up the gym and I take a little spill. I fall and I was like, "That's weird." You know, dropped the keys, couldn't get my right hand to work. And it just went downhill from there. I couldn't, my right side of my body started to shut off. Lost vision in my left eye. By the time I got to the hospital, I was just falling. I'd take like 3 steps and face plant, you know. Got myself into the hospital. And they took me back immediately. They did blood work. They said, "Hey, you know, can't figure out what's going on, but you have a D-dimer, which is an enzyme that indicates you have some sort of like a stroke or something of that nature." So they put me in an MRI, put a dye into my brain to try to see what's going on, which is trippy. I've never done acid or anything like that, but I imagine it was pretty close. Because everything becomes really vivid, you know, like sensory-wise. But I also was on a lot of Dilaudid pain medication, so I really wasn't feeling anything. And they kept putting me in the MRI, then they'd take me out. They'd put me in the MRI and take me out. And it started to correct itself through the medication, so they chose to not do surgery. They put me in their critical care unit once they felt like I was stable enough. They put me in a critical care unit, and that's where I stayed for a couple weeks, and then I came home, and it was a really unique experience.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I have a lot of gratitude from that experience, as a result of that experience, rather. And, you know, there's a lady in the room next to mine, because in critical care, you have one nurse to your room. So, like, it's my room, and there's another room kind of kitty corner to me. So, like, off at a 45.
Yeah.
And the nurse's station is right between our rooms. And then that whole pod of the hospital is like that. So, there's one nurse to every two beds, you know. So, it's kind of like I tell people, I joke around, like, if you're going to be in the hospital, be in critical care.
Yeah.
Because intensive care means you're out of it. You're probably trached and you're just out of it, you know. But if you're in critical care, you still get the same level of treatment. You still have one nurse, but you're awake, you know, and you can kind of
sponge bath.
Yeah, exactly. I need a sponge bath, you know. And but yeah, man, they we were talking about it earlier, you know, one of the things is like they wouldn't let me go to the bathroom by myself, you know, and that kind of stuff. So that's kind of miserable, but because I was a fall hazard, you know. But I busted up my wrist. My left wrist is all busted up. I busted the right side of my jaw. I didn't break. Technically, I didn't break both sides of my jaw. I just busted the right side. So I've got like a weird scar tissue thing going on that side. But it doesn't hurt when I eat any longer. So that's cool. I'll take it. You know, I busted a bunch of my teeth, you know, falling, you know, landing on my face. So my bottom row of my teeth are kind of jacked up from getting pushed around. And then it took me about 3 months to get my vision back in my left eye. It took me 3 or 4 months to get the use of my hand back to where I could go to work. And I was able to walk without tripping. I would drag my foot when I walk. I'd drag my right foot. So I had to figure out a way to disguise that so I could get to work and, you know, they wouldn't know. So just kind of would over exaggerate my step with my right foot. I'd consciously pick my knee up, focus on picking my knee up, and then that way my toe wouldn't drag when I walk, so I wouldn't trip, you know. And it was a good experience though, because for the first time in my life I had to deal with the questions of, are you going to be able to work again? Are you going to be able to roll ever again? Because at that time, my neurosurgeon, neurologist, like, no contact sports ever again. You can't get hit. Like, your head, you can't get hit. I wasn't able to drive, you know, so I had to depend upon other people to take me anywhere I needed to go. That's a whole other blow to the ego, you know. And even simple things like memory, you know, I lost huge chunks of my memory. I'm getting some of it back, you know, but some of it I probably will never get back. But there were like different things, like, you know, my brother would show me a picture and like, hey, remember this? But no, you know, like I know I was there, you know, obviously I know what happened because that's me in the picture, but I don't recall, you know, so that's frustrating.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of frustrating to not have a memory on some things, but at the same time, you know, I guess the only real word I can use is blessed or whatever you want to say. I'm fortunate that, I have what I have.
Yeah.
You know, I don't feel like, because the lady that was in the room next to mine, she didn't make it. She had the same thing I had. She was at work, stood up from her station at work and collapsed. And they rushed her to the hospital. They did surgery. They did do the coil. And then while she was there in critical care, she had another one. And that was it. You know, her body couldn't take anymore because that's a big part of it, right? It's like being healthy, being strong saved me.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, it's a strange conversation to have with doctors and stuff. And I have a lot of friends that are doctors that I know through training and that type of thing that they all say the same thing. They're like, man, you got lucky because it was on the left side of your head. It shut off the right side of your body. That's never good. Hmm. You know, you're fortunate that you made it at all. And so I never forget that. You know, I always, when I think about it, all I think about is I'm just glad I'm here. I'm fortunate, man. You know, and that lady, for whatever reason, her body just couldn't win the second fight that it had to take on, you know. So, you know, when I left the hospital, I just thought like, all right, you know, for whatever reason, things worked out in my favor this time around. So let's act like it.
Oh, you're a fighter.
Yeah, 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 you know. So it's like, let's be a little more grateful, a little more positive, a little more of who I should be.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, cause we all fight that, man. We all, you know, have those days where we're just not positive. We're just not. And I'm a big believer in PMA, you know, Bad Brains, and those guys, you know, really influenced me when I was a kid. Actually, my first license plate was FVK. You know, Fearless Vampire Killers, the Bad Brain song.
Yeah.
And so that was my first license plate. And when I would, and I played in a band called Fearless Vampire Killers, you know, when I was like 14, 15.
So PMA, positive mental attitude. For yeah, man. Those out there that are like, well, my wife has PMS. What is PMA?
Right. This is where Kate should be like pulling something up on YouTube, you know?
Come on, Jamie.
Come on. Yeah, but that was so important to me, you know, that whole process of believe and achieve.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I mean, I have belief tattooed across my stomach. You know, that's how much that's important to me, you know? I still never got the FVK tattoo. I always told myself I'd get.
I'm your guy.
You got to do it, man.
I'm your guy. Let's do it.
Yeah, we'll do it tomorrow.
We'll do a podcast while we're doing
while you're tattooing me. We'll do it tomorrow. Well, we can't do it because you're all jacked up. You can't be all hunched over.
It won't take long.
But
we'll wake up and go do it.
Put it on my forehead. But I always wanted to get that one tatted on me.
Yeah.
You know, because it's just like when I was a kid, man, it just influenced me so heavily, you know, too. Always believe, you know, always believe in yourself, always keep on keeping on, always keep moving, you know, and I there's been times in my life where my mantra almost minute by minute was, you know, things in motion, stay in motion.
Yeah.
Let's keep moving, you know, and especially recovering, you know, from that. I try to keep my ego in check, but I've got a lot of pride, man. You know, I'm not going to lie, you know, and arrogance, you know, I'm an arrogant dude, you know, I can be, you know, and I know that, you know, and I work on it. And so having to ask somebody to take me somewhere, having to ask somebody to help me walk up the stairs, you know, or to, you know, just the most embarrassing things you can think, you know, like, you know, having to have somebody stand there with the door open while I go to the bathroom, you know, and things like that, you know,
humbles
you, man. Right. Yeah. And, but at the same time, it also makes you just realize how awesome some people are. Like, I could never be a nurse. I could not be I would put a pillow over some dude's face right then and there, like Jamaican breathing treatment, man. I would suffocate that dude, you know, the first time he threw something at me or was mean or something. But nurses take it and they just keep trying to do the best they can for you. And just seeing what appeared to be above and beyond that the nurses did for me to make me comfortable, and the doctors too, you know. And I remember somebody talking about my neurologist, you know, and like, cause you know, when you're in that world where you're going to rehab and doing all this stuff, you run into people and they're like, who's your doctor? You know? And I'm like, oh, tell my doctor. And like, oh, she's so arrogant. You know, patient, whatever it's called, bedside manner. Right. Yeah. It's just not very good. And I remember thinking, I think she's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, like she saved my butt, you know? So I'm digging it. So,
perspective, but, right?
Yeah. So from my perspective, it was like, hey, you know, I want somebody who's that confident in their abilities, who's arrogant. You know, they know they can do what they say they can do. Yeah. You know, but yeah, it was an eye opener, man, to be in a place like that. You know, to go from being able to, you know, do some incredible things with my body, as far as strength and that kind of stuff goes, and sports and athletics, and to go from somebody who, you know, I would have guys, you know, we joke around and we'd goof off, and I'm like, man, I can run like a 5 second 40 right now, you know, like not a 4 or 5, but I can run an under 5:40 right now. You guys like, oh, bullshit. You know, you're 40, you're 42, 43 years old. I'm like, let's do it, man.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Yeah. And then I do it, you know, and like, I can dunk a basketball. You can't dunk a basketball. You're not even over 6 feet tall. I'm like, right. How much money you got?
Yeah.
You know, and to go from that to, I can't walk up the stairs by myself, you know, was a really cool experience, you know, to go through that, because all of a sudden I now understood what it's like for somebody who would say to me, I can't get off the couch, or I can't walk on a treadmill. To me, that was just such an absurd thing to say,
yeah.
You know, to hear, you know, like, how would you ever let that come out of your mouth? But then to be in that position where, you know, I remember like we were talking, you know, when I decided to stop taking all the drugs and stuff that I was on, you know, that moment was one of those moments where it's like, hang on a second, you know, at 9 o'clock this morning, I told Nikki I was going to go get on the treadmill and walk for 30 minutes. And now here she is at 10 o'clock at night, waking me up to tell me, hey, let's go to bed. You need to go lie down. I've got to go to work, because she worked overnights. And so she was going to make sure I could get up the stairs on my own and get to bed. And to look at that and realize, like, oh, that's how it happens. You know, like, sometimes it's beyond your control.
What sort of help did you get to get over, like, get a, it was opiates.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can't just, like, be like, okay, I'm done, and move on with your day, you know, unless you got somebody following you with a wheelbarrow, you know, catching the shit running down your leg. So what sort of help?
I didn't have any. I just quit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was not... That was not bright. That was not a good move. I was on 250 mgs of propranolol every day to keep my blood pressure. Because I had intracranial swelling. And so their concern was, if my brain doesn't return to a normal size, they're going to have to cut a chunk out of the side of my head, you know, to let my brain have room to expand until it can return. And so I was on all this propranolol, and so that was causing me to be just loopy, because I would stand up and get dizzy and then sit down. I'd fall asleep, you know, because my blood pressure was so artificially low. And then I was on all kinds of opiates, you know, and that's a dangerous thing. And the looking back on it, the kind of those justifications, you know, that I would have, conversations I'd have with myself, you know, like, well, the doctor said not to get behind the pain train, you know, because if you let the pain get ahead of us, we might not be able to get you caught up again. Like, we might have to bring you in and give you like an IV with Dilaudid and all this stuff. And so, you know, like, all right, well, I'm supposed to take my next pill at 11. It's 9:30. I might fall asleep, because I do that now. So I might fall asleep, and then I might not wake up in time to take the pill. And then that means I'm behind. So I'll just take it now. And then end of the day, I lost track of how many pills I took.
Yeah.
You know, so ended up with some issues there, you know, and then when that happened with Nikki, where she's, you know, telling me, like, hey, go upstairs. And I'm thinking, I don't even know where the day went. I just zombied out, all day on this couch. So I said, that's it. I'm quitting everything. Went, put everything in a bag, threw it away, which you're not supposed to do, right?
No.
Did not dispose of it properly. So hopefully I don't get in trouble for that. Hopefully statute of limitations or something. You know? But
well, somebody was happy.
Somebody got it, right? Yeah. So I was in trouble, man. Threw all that stuff out, and then got really sick for quite a few days, to the point that I finally gave in. Well, I didn't really give in. I called my neurologist to tell her, hey, I can't come in because I can't get 10 feet from a bathroom. I'm so sick. I don't even know if I can walk, you know? Yeah. And that's what led to the conversation of what happened, what's going on. Is this a stomach bug or did you eat something or what's happening? And I just told her, well, I stopped taking all the medicine.
Yeah.
And then we had the conversation about, well, there's a protocol to step you off.
Yeah.
And you violated it. And
dope sickness kills a lot of people.
Yeah. And that's what she said. Basically, you know, you've made it this far. You're not dead. So let's just stay the course. I want to see you, though, you know, tomorrow. So I had to come in the next day. And at first she was trying to talk me into going to the emergency room and I wouldn't do it, you know. And so she's like, well, we'll send an ambulance for you. And, you know, so I'm having this ridiculous conversation with a doctor, no less, who's way smarter than me. But I'm having this ridiculous conversation of, we'll send an ambulance for you. And I'm like, well, I won't answer the door, you know, like, good luck, you know. They'll open the door. That's what they do. I'm like, well, I won't be here. You know, it's just a stupid conversation, you know. But, so the next day I went and they checked me out. And they're like, okay, well, you're over the hump. You're not going to die. For some reason, you're pretty hard to kill. So, you know, we'll just, you know, you know. I chalked that up to Neanderthal blood, you know. I did that DNA testing.
Yeah.
I did it through two different places just for giggles. Because I'm always skeptical of that stuff.
Yeah.
So I did it through two places and it was kind of cool. Both came back almost identical.
Yeah.
Just slight differences in information they report to you, but everything, the main stuff was identical. And then both of them were like, you know, of the general population, you have more Neanderthal DNA than 97%. One said 93%, the other said 97% of the general population. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I'll take it. You know,
seems to be working for
it. I'll take it. You know, it's keeping me alive, so I'm good with it. So that's kind of how that all went down. It was definitely a learning experience. Definitely causes me to be more empathetic to people in that situation. People who have issues with pills or whatever it might be, or drinking. I now understand that feeling of, you know, that justification.
Yeah, the phenomenon of craving.
Yeah, yeah.
The program they talk about it is the phenomenon of craving. And no matter what, you don't want to use, but you can't help it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's...
And that weird inner conversation of, you know... Because I remember exactly where I was standing when I had that conversation with myself. You know, like talking about it. I was standing next to our pantry. You know, and there's our house, it's a 100-year-old house. The pantry is built into the wall. And so I'm standing there looking in the pantry. I don't even know what at, because I was so stoned out of my mind. I was just standing there looking in the pantry probably for like 30 minutes, you know, and zombied out. And I remember looking out the window outside, you know, and it was kind of, it was one of those winter days where it's snowy, but it's sunny. I remember thinking, man, I want to go outside, you know, and then thinking, well, what if I fall asleep outside? Because I'm so out of control of my body, you know, and then having that conversation of, yeah, I'll probably fall asleep. So I should take my pills now. Yeah, I should probably take the Norco now because I don't want to get behind the pain train. And having this inner dialogue, you know, like, yeah, Doc says to... not get behind the pain train, you know, like it's better to not get there because then we got to start all over again, and we finally got your pain under control. And so then I just like walked over to the other cabinet, got some pills out and took them, you know, even though I'm, you know, 90 minutes ahead of schedule for when I'm supposed to take them, which might not be a big deal. I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but I do know this, that it was not in specs or whatever the terminology is. I was not taking it as prescribed. I was taking it as justified by myself.
As like, prescribed by yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Like Dr. Paul decided, you know, hey, you know, this is a good idea. And it will, and so I can kind of relate to whatever degree that I can.
Yeah.
To that, as well as the issues where people are not in control of their body. You know, telling somebody who's not in control of their body, like, hey, you should get up and get off that couch and go for a walk. Might not be possible.
No.
So figure out a way to meet them where they are and help them where they are to get to where they can go for a walk. They can get on the mat someday and do some jiu-jitsu, you know, or whatever it is that, that they want to do. But yeah, that was a wake up call, man. That was a good experience for me. As negative as it was a good experience.
So in that timeline, because I know it was shortly after you went through that when I met you for the first time at the Portland camp.
Yeah.
Where in that timeline was did that happen? Like, was it just shortly after your surgery or?
No, no. So I didn't have surgery. They were able to do it medically.
Okay.
With the medicine, the clot busters did their thing and saved my butt.
Okay.
Know? Also, the blood went all down my spine. So my spinal cord, so that basically set my body on fire. So every nerve in my body was just firing because of the blood in my spine. Because it was right here, right at the base of my skull. If it had gone upwards onto my brain, it would have killed me, but it went down the spine. And so that's good and bad because the spinal cord is, there's only so much room in there. And now you dump all this blood down there and it just basically felt like, you know how like you hit your elbow really hard, your funny bone? That's what my whole body felt like. My whole body was just on fire, just that nerve pain. And that went on for a long time. That stuck around for almost a year, the nerve pain. So I met you, that was that fall camp in Portland?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was almost a year later. So November 9th, 2014, I got my black belt in March of 2015. So, and then the next camp I went to was either that spring camp. That might have been the spring camp in Portland. I'd have to figure out whenever that camp
was. Because they did back-to-back. So
we
were unable to make it to the second one, which was, I believe, spring camp.
Okay, so then it would have been the fall camp.
Yeah, the fall camp.
Yeah, so yeah, the fall camp was my first camp as a black belt, and yeah, and that was right after the aneurysm, and that was so hard, man, because I couldn't roll.
How long did you take off rolling?
I took off until, let's see, that was my longest layoff, including the time I had knee surgery. So I had knees, they put my knee back together and I was rolling 2 weeks later with a brace on my leg and stuff. But the aneurysm was the longest I took off. I want to say it wasn't until February. January. So November to the end of January before I started. Before I started rolling again.
Did the doctors ever give you the okay to roll again?
I'm not supposed to ever roll.
What did Nikki say?
We didn't talk about it. We never had that conversation. Her most kind of frequent response to stuff like that is just, you're dumb, you know? The doctor told me to never risk getting my head hit again because they can't figure out what caused it. They have no idea, you know? I don't drink, I don't smoke, never smoked in my life. All those things, all the risk factors don't exist for me. So what is it? what caused it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, if they ever traced it back to like a Genesis event or.
Yeah, nothing, man. They can't figure it out. Nobody in my family's ever had anything like that. Hmm. So I'm the only one. You know, my dad died of pancreatic cancer, but that, and he was healthy his whole life, never had issues. He always had headaches, but that was also just stress. He's just high strung dude, you know? And, but yeah, man, I started rolling in January. That was so frustrating, you know, 'cause my brain wasn't firing correctly and my body wasn't firing correctly. So that's just a cluster, you know, that's just a cluster bomb of frustration because my, I can't get my body to move the way I know it should move to do simple things like pass the guard or hold a position. And my brain is like five moves behind whatever my friend or my training partner's doing. So I'm trying to, I remember one of my first hard roles was in March, right after I got my black belt, and I rolled a pretty, I mean, not counting Chris and everything when they Iron Man me for my black belt. But after that, I was in Memphis and I trained with my friend Cecil Birch and Larry Lindemann and Chris Fry. And we all just kind of commandeered this boardroom in a hotel. And we're like, hey, we're going to have a meeting. And they're like, okay, cool. And nice. We went in there and rolled on the carpet. And I remember my first hard roll was with Larry. You know, he's a good dude, you know, but he's hardcore. You know, he trains hard. And that was my first hard roll. And I just remember just complete frustration and a moment of, I'm never going to do jiu-jitsu again. Mm. Like, just, it's over. They're right. I can't do this. The doctor's right. The neurosurgeon's right. I can't do this anymore. And I remember talking to Larry, and he's known me a long time, you know. And I remember talking to him after we got done training, and he said, man, he goes, I can feel you starting to move and then nothing happens. And I told him, I go, yeah, man, like I can see what I need to do. Like at an instinctive level, I know what I need to do because I've done it for so long, you know, literally decades of rolling. I know what I need to do, but my body won't cooperate. And then what's worse is my brain won't cooperate. Like my brain won't override whatever it is that's in the way to move. And I remember telling him like, hey man, I think it's over. Like, I don't think I can roll at a high level ever again.
Well, it's good thing you were wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. And I remember him saying to me, well, just don't stop rolling. Mm-hmm. Just don't stop.
Yeah,
just,
great advice.
Yeah. Yeah. Just keep rolling, man. Just don't stop, you know? And he kind of has a reputation as being a hardcore, pretty brutal dude. And, but he's also a good guy, you know? And when he said that to me, it struck a chord, you know, cause I could tell he genuinely as a friend, but as a friend giving me coaching advice, he was being sincere. He wasn't just busting my balls.
There's that sincerity again.
Yeah, yeah, right. Like he wasn't busting my balls. For once, Larry was not being the murder cat that he is. You know, like Larry was being like just very sincere and saying like, just don't stop rolling, man. Like keep rolling. And even if you never roll at a high level again, you're still going to be rolling. And that's what you love. So even if it's frustrating, you got to keep doing it, you know? And he's like, maybe, and he made a couple good points about maybe you have to accept this is the best that you're ever going to roll again. So forget about the past, forget about what you could have done, what you used to do, mm-hmm. and focus on what you can do, you know, like you can still get in here and roll. So get in here and roll. And so that's what I did. You know, I just kept rolling to whatever degree I could. If I get bumped in the head, I remember I got kneed in the head pretty good that summer, you know. And I'm still seeing a neuros neurologist at this point. Like once a month, I'm still having to see somebody, and they're putting those needles in my head, doing the EEG with on nerve across my skull, which is a wonderful experience. And putting the electrodes on it, man. And I just sit there and wait for the pain to start, you know. And they're doing all that stuff. And I remember in June, getting kneed in the head. And like right on the same side too, like white belt, right? Swings around, knees me right here, going to side control. And just there's like a burst of light. Mm-hmm. And my head immediately started hurting really bad. And then there was panic, you know, there was just overwhelming anxiety of like, here we go. Like I'm screwed. I'll never roll again. I should have been rolling. They told me not to roll. This is what I get for not listening. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what happens when you don't listen. You know, this is what happens when you're a hard head. You learn the hard way, you know? And, I had a headache for about 3 days and then it went away. And so of course, I went right back to the gym, you know, I was like, let's go roll again, you know?
Yeah.
But I actually talked with Leah and Matt quite a bit about that because I had anxiety issues big time when I'd roll. If anybody would get on top of me, you know, anybody would hold me down, anybody would get in a position where, I felt like my head was being pushed, which is everywhere when they're on top of you. Like if somebody's mounting you or they have side control, what do they do, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that cross face or anything, like it would freak me out. I'd start losing it, you know, and I'd have this internal, I'd actually tap, I'd actually be like, hey man, I gotta get up for a second. And people would look at me like, what is going on with you, man? You know, it happened with Matt at the Boise camp. You know, we're rolling around a little bit and I was like, I gotta get up, dude, you gotta let me up. And
I know, like, that feeling.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, are you okay? You're all right, man? You're all right, you know? And I was like, you know, I'm fine, man. Like physically I'm fine. Like, you know, I'm used to pressure, you know, I mean, after a couple of decades of rolling, like I'm used to pressure, you know, but this was different. This was, I felt like the world was closing in. I felt like I'm trying to breathe through a straw. Everything's getting black. I can't see. My head's starting to ache. And I got this voice inside going, it's happening again. Mm. It's happening again. You know, and I start freaking out, man. And that's when I finally was like, I got to talk to somebody, you know, like I can't keep doing this, you know, because I love to train from bad positions. Mm-hmm. Like that's how I've trained my whole jiu-jitsu career has been about, hey, just get side control and let me do round after round of trying to get out of somebody holding me down. And that's the most benefit for me mentally, because I feel like if I train like that, if I do like an hour of 5 minute rounds of different, you know, rotating through different training partners of just get back control, get your hooks in, get one collar or get whatever you want to get. And let me try to get out. And I'm just going to repeat this, rinse and repeat for the entire hour, you know, with different guys, just switching out, you know. I feel my strongest after doing that.
Yeah.
Cause I feel like I'm untouchable. Like nothing can hurt me, you know, like no matter where you put me, man, I'm coming back. I'm going to get you, you know? And so from mental and from physical strength viewpoints, that's what I need to do for my training. And I was unable to do that because the second I would feel that pressure building on in my head, I'd freak, you know? And so I talked to Leah and she's like, listen, here's what'll help. You got to do this. You got to do this. The different exercises you have to do mentally, breathing exercises you have to do. And then I talked to Dr. William April, you know, he's a psychologist, and he gave me some things to work on and some exercises to do. And then at the end of the day, I just had to get back in there and just do it. Just get vulnerable, let people get positions on me. And saying let as it, not to be derogatory, as if there's no other way they were going to get there on me, you know,
no.
But just put myself in those places, put myself in those positions. Like if somebody starts to turn me into that you know, they pass and they start to get to my back, or they pass and they start to get to side control, to allow, to just accept it and say, now's my opportunity to work from here again, to do what I love. This is what I love. I love that bad position. I love being in that position where it sucks, and then working my way out of it, because mentally now I'm going to look at myself and go, yeah, dude, like, no matter what they throw at you, you're good to go, you know? And so having to like go back to that was so hard, you know, and so many panic attacks, man. So many times sitting in it was like being a white belt again, you know, in a lot of ways, because it was like being that white belt sitting in my car again, hoping that Conan doesn't show up, you know, because they're on Brazilian time. And so sitting outside the gym in Miami, and just, it's like 20 minutes after class is supposed to start, and none of those guys are there yet. And I remember sitting there going, cool, if they don't show up, I can go home, because they just beat the crap out of me yesterday, yeah, you know. And then seeing them walk up and going, oh man, come on, like, I got to go in now, you know. But as a black belt, experiencing that was an incredibly unique feeling again of, man, like, I don't want to go in there, you know, like, I don't want to do the thing I love. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that I don't want to tap, you know, it wasn't that I don't want to struggle or whatever the case may be. It's not that I didn't want to grind. It's that I didn't want to be put in that position where I felt like the world's closing in around me and I can't do anything about it. And that is it's hard to explain unless people have experienced it, you know? And I've never had anxiety, man. I mean, I've been a SWAT guy. I've done undercover stuff. My daughter, my youngest daughter, wrote one time, she had to write a thing for school about her dad, you know, or about somebody in her life, you know? And so she chose me, and she wrote that, see if I can remember it correctly. Basically, she wrote, sometimes I sit and wonder what crazy thing my dad's doing right now. Like, what thing is he climbing up onto so he can jump off of it? What car is he driving really fast? Or what bike is he riding really fast? Like, I wonder what crazy thing my dad's doing, and then I hope he doesn't die, you know? And so, you know, to go from that kind of persona to a person who's afraid to have somebody sit on them.
Yeah.
You know, that's bizarre, right? That's like, man, you know, like, how'd I get here? And even more importantly, how do I get out of here? You know? And I think the easy thing would have been to just quit. Just accept what the doctor said, because they're smarter than me.
Yeah, but they're not always right.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. But just to accept that, hey, man, maybe I shouldn't roll over again. And I had doctors that, like I said, I've got friends, doctors that are friends who also outside of their, you know, they're not my doctor. I mean, you live in Dallas and Tennessee, you know, and Nashville, places like that. But I had these guys that were longtime friends of mine and training partners who were like, hey, man, like, might be time to call it a day. There's other things you can do, you know, like, you can just teach. You don't have to do this. You can just teach self-defense stuff, and you'll never get hit in the head again unless you have to fight,
yeah,
you know, for your life. But in that case, who cares, right? You got to get it on. But, and again, back to kind of the pills thing, where I kind of had this self-talk, this conversation, this internal dialogue of, you know, they're right. And maybe these panic attacks or this anxiety is just my body's way of telling me they're right. You know, call it a day, hang it up. You did accomplish what you wanted. You know, you got your black belt. You don't have to do anything else. And there was guys in jiu-jitsu that told me that too. You know, those guys in jiu-jitsu that were like, hey, man, everybody knows you're good. Like, everybody that's ever trained with you knows, you know, you're good. You got nothing to prove. You got your black belt. You've done it. Like, just coach or just teach self-defense stuff. Just if you're having issues with this, man, just maybe it's your body's way of saying, like, you probably shouldn't get hit in the head anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Are you still struggling with it?
Sometimes. Yeah, man, sometimes. You know, sometimes I'll have issues. And then when that happens, I put myself out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll go out there. And I've had friends that talk to me and tell me, like, hey, you can't roll with everybody in the room anymore. You can't do that anymore because your body can't take it. And they're right. You know, I pay a price for that. But sometimes it's that mental issue, you know, where the anxiety is going to win, you know, if I don't roll. So I will go out there and intentionally put myself in bad positions. I'll do things intentionally to make it so that they end up on my back or on top of me or hold me down, and just find a way to just center myself in that moment, in that place, and just remind my mantra is that I love this stuff.
Yeah.
I just repeatedly say that to myself. My internal dialogue is, I love this stuff. I love this stuff.
I can relate to the making yourself do it. Like when we were in Mexico last year, the ocean decided it was going to make me its bitch.
And yeah, yeah.
Tumble me around on the bottom for a couple of minutes. And, you know, I thought for sure, you know, I remember thinking, man, this is how I die.
Yeah, I remember we that talked sucks. About that. Yeah.
You know, and all said and done, I eventually ended up back on shore alive. Yeah. And I told Katie, I have to go walk back into the ocean. Because if I don't wade back into the ocean a little bit, I don't know if I'll ever get back in again.
You'll never go back.
You know?
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. So, and that's what I do. And I know it, you know, there's multiple conversations about how hard should you go in training and how intense should your training be and that kind of thing. And I know Matt has scolded me, Adam Singer too, you know, has scolded me over the years about going too hard in training. And they're right. You know, like, yeah, there's a need for that at times, but not all the time. And I've struggled with that. But at the same time, over the last, since the aneurysm, sometimes I have to go that hard from those bad positions. I have to put myself in those positions where I'm just getting ground up, you know, and you know, Adam was talking with me recently about, like, picking and choosing your roles, because the body only has so many left, you know, kind of like a boxer. You only have so many knockouts left. Right. Mm-hmm. And he's 100% correct. You know, he's absolutely right. And he is one of the smartest people I know, especially when it comes to this stuff. But at the same time, you know, I have to look at mentally. If I don't roll like that on those days when anxiety is kicking my ass, I'll never roll again. Same thing, right? Like, if I walk off that mat on that day and I don't, like, if I don't walk out, like, if Kate's the only person on the mat, if I don't walk out there and say, listen, I realize you're like 100 pounds less than me, but I need you to get on my back and just go after me, you know, submit me 15 ways from Sunday, you know, I know if I don't do that, I probably won't step on the mat again, and I will probably find a way to justify not doing this again. I will be one of those black belts that doesn't roll, you know, because the anxiety will have won. And once it starts winning, I don't know where it stops winning.
Yeah, for sure.
And I'm afraid of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm terrified of that, because what's next?
Yeah.
I'm afraid to leave my house because if I hit my head, I'm going to die. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's how irrational that fear becomes. You know, it's so irrational. It's so unexplainable. And going through it and experiencing it, especially for a guy who spent his whole life, like, you know, PMA and just believe and achieve and, you know, all that good stuff,
yeah.
You know, to be in a position where it's like, man, you know, my brain's kind of betraying me here. You know?
I get it. I mean, anxiety's become such a buzzword that I don't think a lot of people who talk about anxiety really understand just how all in, like it feels like drowning. Feels like you can thrash
right.
and try to breathe and it just swallows you up.
Yeah. And I've talked to other people and I wouldn't betray their trust, you know, but other people in SPG that have helped me deal with this, I've talked to them and they've shared with me like, hey, you know, it got to a point where I had to walk out of the room. I felt like I was going to lose my shit. I was going to have some sort of breakdown and I didn't know what that was going to look like.
Yeah.
So I had to get away for a second, you know, and that's just something that like, I never dealt with, you know, I just have never dealt with it. You know, I've never been in a position where I couldn't like rappelling off the side of a building or doing a lot of cool things I've had the opportunity to do. Never felt that. I always felt a rush. I always felt like this is cool as fuck, man. You know, like that was always my attitude was like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm about to step off the side of a 15 story building and rappel down to the 10th floor, you know, and like, this is awesome, you know, and to have that feeling of just overwhelming fear, panic and blackness, you know, take over me simply because somebody's got their shoulder on the side of my head, you know, pushing me or their knees on my chest and their hands grabbing my collar. And I can feel like this weird, I can feel the blood pounding in my head, you know, cause a choke's imminent, right? You know, we've all felt that, right?
Yeah.
But it's freaking me out and I'm freaking out because I'm don't know why. Mm-hmm. I just don't know why I'm freaking out about my head feeling like this, you know? And, it's weird, man. It's unexplainable.
And that, for me, in there lies the beauty of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or Jiu-Jitsu. We'll just call it Jiu-Jitsu.
Yeah.
Because all you have to do is surrender.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it teaches you to surrender, that you don't always have to grit through it and clench your teeth and, you know what I mean, accept your fate. You can just tap, surrender.
Yeah,
reset.
Exactly. Yeah, reset, man. Just start it over. And that's the important thing is that reset, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I can tap and there isn't anybody that I roll with that's not going to honor the tap, you know? And so I can tap, get up and walk out of the room. Yeah, she might not honor
Katie her. Might not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. She might. Never. She might be like, no, you can't tap to that. I'm not. I will not allow you to tap to that. You know,
let me Google this.
Yeah, right. No,
that's exactly. Not tap worthy.
That's not an acceptable tap. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, if I tap and then I walk out of the room, it's over.
Yeah.
Never going to come back. But if I tap and I go, don't move, man, just like give me a second. And this was one of the things Leah said to do was just, if you have to, tell him like, hey, give me a second.
Yeah.
Like just give me a second and then we'll start again. Exactly as we are. Like, don't move. Just whatever's going on, man, I can't get control of it.
Yeah.
It's starting to run away on me. This cascade is beginning and I'm getting better at feeling it coming. So let me just get it under control and then we'll start again, you know? And that's why I'm looking forward to competing again, you know, as crazy as it sounds, right? It's like you're 52 years old, you're going to compete again. Like, why, you know? And I've had conversations with my friends where they're like, what do you need to compete for? I'm like, why would you compete? I'm like, first off, I love it. I can't help it. I compete at everything. I mean, it's like the joke, right? Like if we get on a treadmill at the gym and a guy gets on the treadmill next to me, we're racing.
Yeah.
He might not know it, but we're racing.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm just hyper competitive, you know, I'm kind of a dick like that.
How's that go over with Travis?
I'm more competitive than Travis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Exactly. I say that just.
Did you hear that, Travis? Yeah, Paul said he's more competitive.
I am more competitive than Travis. I like saying that because it bugs him. But Yeah, I am hyper competitive, and I love rolling with Travis. Yeah. You know, because he's the same way, you know. But he rolls to learn. You know, he's a student of fighting. You know, we're a lot alike in that he just loves fighting. Anything to do with fighting, I want to learn it, just like he does, you know. And that's why he trains with, like, 10th Planet guys, and he'll train judo, and he's powerlifting, and you know what I mean? Because anything that makes me better at fighting, I want to do it, you know. You know, I'm hyper-competitive, and I love to compete. And if I'm not competing at jiu-jitsu, I'm competing in a shooting sport, or I'm running a half marathon, or you know, something of that nature. Like, I'm going to do something to compete. Like, I can't help it, you know? And plus it helps me because I am to some degree goal oriented, you know? And, I'm process focused, but also goal focused at the same time, you know, like, I value the process, but I like that goal. Like, I like achieving something. And so I'm going to compete again. And, but for me, the first competition, like, I don't want to cop out and say, like, my first competition, I don't expect to win. Like, absolutely, I want to win. Like, why would I go out there if I didn't want to win? But I'm curious to see what's going to happen with the anxiety stuff. Yeah. Like, I'm curious to see how well I'm going to manage that. You know, how am I going to do with that? Yeah. So that's going to be a learning experience for me, because I've never competed with that issue, with that specter kind of in the background. I've never had that issue. I've always been, if anything, I've had the issue of wanting to run out there and just get after it. You know what I mean? And I've always had my brother and guys that have cornered me have always had to rein me in. They've always had to be like, settle down, you know? And even Adam, you know, like, recently we had a chance to roll when I was in Georgia, and Rory was competing. So, and Rory's a super competitive dude too. And he was competing the next day. So we had a chance to roll and get some rounds in. Adam's got some really good theories on rolling the day before competition, based on delayed onset muscle soreness and things like that. And we could talk about that off the air, because I don't want to give away Adam's secret sauce.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely want to hear
about it. It's solid theories on that stuff. And it actually worked. It actually was effective, you know. But rolling with Rory prior to that, I was able to not be hyper competitive, because my focus was, let's just get some rolls in, you know, let Rory stretch out, let him run a little bit. Not that he couldn't run if I was trying to be competitive, but my concern was hurting him, like the danger of like a weird injury happening, you know, or something like that. But then when I got to roll with the other guys, you know, there's like Brian Bowles and Kelsey and those guys who are, you know, not competing. Then it was like, hey, let's go. Yeah. You know, let's have some fun. And Adam was like, man, rein it in, you know, like, you know, not that I was being a jerk or that they didn't want to roll that hard with me, because yeah, obviously they did. They were trying to kill me. But it was more of, you know, Adam's thing was like, hey, man, like, just chill.
Yeah.
Don't roll so hard. But, you know, in my mind, I want to compete again. And so I kind of have that mindset of, every time I get on the mat, I want to put the foot on the gas pedal and stomp it. And let's just go. And let's have fun. And let's just rip. And also kind of feel that draining of the tank. Feel that emptying of the lungs. Feel that depletion of glycogen and everything else. And that's when the panic comes in, right?
Yeah.
That's when that demon shows up, because now I'm stuck and I'm in a bad position and I have no strength left. I can't muscle my way out, and I can't get my head clear to technique my way out, because panic is overriding everything.
Yeah.
You know,
I felt that Friday when I got kind of crushed.
Yeah, when you got caught, right? Yeah, you got hurt.
I wanted to quit. Like my brain was telling me, quit, just stop now. You know what I mean? And it was kind of like, nah, man, Paul Sharp's running comp team. And you know what? Like all those voices.
Right.
And I just finished it up and haven't been able to really do anything for 2 days, but look good and run a camera. You know what I mean?
I walk around being handsome.
Yeah.
But, you know, but that's the thing is sometimes, despite what might be best physically to, for me, like Adam's advice of, hey, like, calm down, settle down, you know, like roll more efficiently, conserve more energy, you know, use these survival positions like the iron pillow and things like that. That is solid advice. That is absolutely what I need to do physically. But mentally, you know, dealing with that demon, until I can kill that demon, I need to do what I'm doing. You know,
if and you know sense. You best.
If that makes sense, you know, it's like I've got I've got to constantly be putting myself in this position where I'm compromised, I'm vulnerable, and let me continue to try to solve this Rubik's Cube of anxiety. That's playing out in my head. Because physically I can recover. Like, physically I could drink some water, maybe get a massage, you know, like eat some more nutritious food, and I'll recover physically from the effort. But mentally, man, like that's the thing that I'm trying to figure out right now is how do I, if I never, and this is one of the things talking to a counselor I've had to accept is that now that anxiety has a foothold, you might never get rid of it because it might actually be that the chemistry of your brain is altered due to the injury. So, you know, that was the hard thing to accept was the counselor saying, you've got traumatic brain injury. You've got multiple concussions. There's evidence of multiple concussions. You know, you've got brain injury. So whether those were contributing or not, doesn't matter. It is what it is. And having a neurologist and a counselor who were communicating with each other and being very frank with me, you know, which I appreciate, and just saying like, maybe this is how it's going to be, man. You know, like maybe your brain has betrayed you. You know, maybe your brain has decided it's had enough, you know, and so anxiety is always going to be an issue. Maybe the injury is what allowed anxiety to get a foothold, is what it is now. What are you going to do? You know, cry about it? Or are you going to find a way to continue to work around it? And so sometimes, man, you know, that's really, that's all that I'm doing. I'm rolling for anti-fragile purposes. I'm rolling for resilience purposes. I'm rolling for mental management purposes more so than what physically it's doing to me. You know, and I think guys like Adam and Travis and guys, I think they get it. Even though it's, they probably also at the same time probably think it's stupid from a physical perspective. They also understand the mental perspective. Like, I got to do this, man. Yeah, I got to conquer this, or that foothold's going to turn into, you know, a stronghold, you know, rather than just something that nags at me here and there. It's going to turn into something full blown. I mean, I don't know, but I don't want to take a chance, you know? So that's, yeah, that's what that's about.
It makes sense.
All right.
I appreciate you sharing that. So we've been going for, looks like an hour and 57 minutes.
Holy cow.
Feels like 5 minutes.
That's
fast.
That's fast.
A couple more questions I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
Want to get into the speed round. Do a speed round. So you want to do that now?
Yeah, whatever you want to do, man. I'm down.
All right. So speed round questions. So
okay,
as quick as possible, I'm going to give you two choices. And then I'm going to end with a ridiculous question.
All right.
All right.
I'm down.
All right.
Let's do it.
Okay. Van Halen or Metallica?
Van Halen.
Sub only or IBJJF?
Sub only.
He-Man or G.I. Joe?
He-Man.
Marvel or DC?
DC.
Carl's Jr. or Steak and Shake?
Steak and Shake.
Glock or Smith & Wesson?
Oh, Smith & Wesson.
All right. Old school or new school?
Old school.
Guard or passing?
Passing.
All right. So you've just won Miss America Beauty Pageant. Right? Congratulations.
As I do.
Yeah.
As
congratulations.
I should. As I should.
All right. What breakfast cereal would you be and tell us why?
If I just won the
Miss You just won Miss America. Miss America Beauty Pageant. What breakfast cereal would you be and why?
Fruity Pebbles. Because it's got a little bit of something for everybody. And nice. It doesn't hurt your mouth. Captain nice. Crunch is good, but then you got to deal with that Captain Crunch mouth.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's not cool. So Fruity Pebbles. It's got,
that was a good thought out response.
Yeah, it's, sure. It's got something for everybody. It's got a lot of green in it. Green's my favorite color.
I thought maybe it was going to be Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. But.
Yeah, right. But those are brown. You know, it's like it's
yeah.
not a very life. You know, color, like it's just all my friends that are brown are gonna be like, fuck you, man. But,
wasn't a racist
thing. Yeah, it wasn't a racist thing, man.
We're not established enough to fucking take man. Those risks right now on like, podcast yeah, episode no, one.
Man. I'm down with brown, man. I love my brown friends. But when it comes to food, you know, especially yeah. cereal,
yeah.
Green's my favorite color. So yeah, yeah it's the color of life.
You know? Yeah, they say geniuses pick green.
Really?
Yeah, they do.
I feel better about it now, right? Yeah. I just pick it because it just makes me happy. Green is just a life color, man. Just,
yeah.
You know, like spring. This is, yeah.
So my next question, are you familiar with Simon Sinek? He wrote The Power of Why.
Kind of, yeah. 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 Okay. I know who you're talking about.
You know,
yeah.
So.
It's S-I-N-E-K, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Not to plug him, but I guess ultimately, like, through everything you've told, you know, and talked about, what's your why? Like, why? What's your why? What gets you up in the morning? What drives you? What keeps you going? What, you know what I mean? What yeah. makes Paul Sharp sharp?
Yeah, yeah. I want to see what's next. You know, like I want to know what makes people tick and what makes me tick. I haven't figured that out yet. You know, like what makes me want to do the things I do. I haven't figured it out. And so why I do everything I do is so, cause I think, and I hope someday I will figure it out. Yeah. Like I will understand it, you know? And, yeah, that's it, man. Curiosity, you know, just genuinely interested in what's going on around me.
Nice.
Yeah.
You have any questions? Got anything else you want to say?
She's fact checking everything.
Busy.
Yeah. She's busy Googling.
Looking up Fruity Pebbles.
how many green Fruity Pebbles are there in a bag of Fruity Pebbles? Right. Nice. If only they could make a whole box of just green Fruity Pebbles.
So what's the cereal company that makes Fruity Pebbles?
That I don't know.
Is it Post?
I think it's Kellogg.
Suppose we. You're the fact checker.
You're the fact checker. You got to fact check that Google. Shit.
You could be like Googling that already. Jeez. Yeah. What do you think? So, Kellogg? She said Kellogg. So
I don't know.
Kellogg. Let's see.
Fruity Pebbles.
Post.
I was right.
Yeah, you were right.
You boom.
Right. Yeah, right.
Yeah,
first thought's the right thought.
What's that? Yeah. What's that saying about a son and a dog's ass?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, right.
But. They owe us some money eventually.
Yeah, they probably should.
When this shit blows up.
Yeah, once you're like world famous worldwide, they're going to have to pay you, man.
Yeah, dude. And then they got to send you a rider of just green Fruity Pebbles.
Yeah, kind of like Kramer, that episode of Seinfeld where, you know, he his lawyer, they were in there negotiating. They offered him free coffee all day, every day for the rest of his life. He's like, I'll take it. Something like that. Yeah. Like, hey, man, I just want a box of Fruity Pebbles every day for the rest of my life.
Yeah, just that's green all. Ones.
Yeah, just that.
Yeah.
And just, I want to make sure the bag's reinforced so I could just pour the milk into the bag and just eat it right out of the box.
That's a genius like idea the right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, I'm telling you, like, why don't they do that? Because I would be down. I would, that's how I would eat it.
You're pretty bright for a guy with a head injury.
Yeah, right. Remember the little boxes of cereal?
Yeah.
You could pour the milk in that box and just eat it right out of the box, right?
Yeah.
Why don't they do it with the big boxes?
You can. I can make you a knife that'll cut through that shit. Like, no problem. Yeah, right.
You got to be careful, though, man. Because, you know, it's like, just get your hand, it gets all messy when you have to dig down to the bottom of the bag.
Just use a bigger spoon with a longer handle.
That's, see?
Efficiency.
Together, we could do anything.
We can.
Together, we could conquer the world.
We got this.
It's probably a good thing you're in Canada and I'm in the States because
true.
We take over.
I agree.
Yeah, it's like the old saying about the Irish and whiskey, right? Mm-hmm. So God invented whiskey so the Irish couldn't rule the world.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it is.
Are you Irish?
No. Well, actually a little bit. Yeah. So a little bit DNA tests for like a little bit Irish, a little bit, a lot of bit Scottish, Jewish, you know, from like Germany, that area, which makes sense. My grandmother's name was Mensch. So it's German Jewish name. And then a lot of like Scandinavian, that kind of, which explains why I burn the second I walk in the sun like a vampire.
Yeah. You know?
Thanks a lot, ancestors.
Yeah, I just tell everybody I'm Irish.
Yeah.
It just makes it easier. I don't think that I actually am Irish.
But it just makes it easier.
Yeah, I'm Irish.
Yeah,
everybody exactly. tells me I look like Conor McGregor. Anyway,
yeah, there you go.
So I'm like, yeah, I'm Irish.
That's awesome. Right? So, yeah, the only thing I'm mad about my ancestry is just the whole I can't tan. You know, like I'm always like I see somebody walk by with a nice tan. They look healthy. And I'm like, man,
more
you know?
Peanut oil, dude.
Yeah. Friend more peanut oil. That's answer. What I needed. I need more peanut oil.
It's a bad idea. Going,
is it?
Yeah. It I'm
not
nipples.
Even. I'm not even yeah. Googling it. It's a bad idea.
Nipples would be smoking.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I'm just like, man, you know, I can't ever get a tan. You know, that's the only thing I regret.
Yeah.
Just thanks a lot of ancestors.
God damn it.
Yeah. It gave me some good DNA for other things. Good genetics. But
yeah.
Ruined it for that.
Like it's a Neanderthal that just hung out in the cave.
That's, yeah, yeah.
Those genetics.
Right. Yeah, it's like, you know, my calves, you know, people always tease me about my legs and stuff. It's like my calves are like 18, 19 inches around.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I never do any exercises for them.
I can lend you some calves, man. I got some calves.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's the thing, right? Like I never do anything for them and they're pretty good, pretty decent. So
yeah.
I got good genetics, but can't tan, you know? I guess it's like my kryptonite. So
it's all right.
Just accept it.
It's all right.
Deal with it. You know.
All right. So I don't know. 2 hours. I'm good to do this for a while, but we should probably wrap her up. But before we do, where can people touch base with you to train or book you for seminars?
Yeah, yeah. So they can contact me through the gym if they want to call. It's 224-325-5246. That's the phone number for the gym. There's always somebody there answering the phone. And then through Facebook, just my name, you know. But there's a bunch of Paul Sharps out there, so.
There's only one Paul
Sharp. Yeah, yeah, make sure you find me.
Yeah.
Make sure you find the right one. On Instagram, it's Paul Sharp, Paul_Sharp_SBG. And then there's also the SBG Illinois Instagram, SBG Illinois Facebook. Those are the best ways to reach me. And then anytime anybody sees me like a camp or anything like that, man, just come up and introduce themselves. You know, it's always kind of weird to me that people tell me like, hey, I saw you, but I didn't want to bother you because you were talking to whomever. And it's like, I don't care, dude, come up and talk to me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care who I'm. You're not bothering me. You know, you're not interrupting. I promise you, you're not interrupting a serious conversation. if it's me and the singers or those guys talking, it's not a serious conversation. Like, you're not going to interrupt anything. So, yeah, please come up and talk to me and, yeah, come train with me.
Yeah.
You know, for sure. You know, and roll with me and train with me and let's learn. Yeah, let's get our learn on.
100%.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, I guess we're going to call us quits on our very first episode.
Yes, the inaugural, the maiden voyage
of
digging it.
The Choking on Truth podcast.
I love it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for anybody who's going to tune in. And if you haven't tuned in, you're missing out.
Yeah.
So tell your friends.
Yeah, right.
All right. Paul Sharp, thank you.
Thank you, man.